This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today's conversation is going to be around creating advanced communities for a distributed future and what's happening in different federal and state initiatives. Lorenzo Christoph is going to start us out, electric system policy, followed by Samuel Golding with Community Choice Partners, then Larissa Dobriansky at General Microgrids, and followed by Bob Perry with Synergistic Solutions. So, Lorenzo, why don't you go ahead and get this conference call on the ground here. Do a four and a start. Unmute your line. Are you there? How long did it for you here? Hang on. You there, Lorenzo?
Okay, it says unmuted now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're good. Yep, can hear you.
Okay, great. All set. Hi. Thanks. Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining the call. I'm going to just go quickly through three key points that I want to make about what's happening with community energy. The first one is the importance of a statewide program for which work has begun in California on this. I'm working in collaboration with the Climate Center in Santa Rosa and several other parties who are part of a team trying to advance legislation in California that would create a statewide program that would provide funding, technical support, all kinds of guidance, et cetera, to enable local governments, state, county and city governments, tribal authorities, et cetera, throughout the state of California to be able to plan local energy systems specifically to advance decarbonization initiatives, to advance resiliency, to advance economic and environmental justice, et cetera, through local projects. And the idea being that in more affluent communities, it may be possible to do this without significant state support, but we want to see a certain level of uniformity across the state, but we also want to see financial support for the less affluent communities. This year, Senator Bill Dodd introduced SB 1314, which would be a great first step in this direction, creating essentially community energy resilience planning through a state program under the Strategic Growth Council. Unfortunately, due to COVID and the abbreviated session, that bill is not going to advance this year, but Senator Dodd indicates that he will bring it back at the beginning of the 2021 session. So that's a really important thing because local community energy planning, I believe, and many of us believe, is where a lot of the action is to achieve California's big goals for decarbonization and resilience and equity. And if you think about where carbon emissions come from and what urban planning deals with or county planning deals with, it has a lot to do with housing patterns, housing density, building codes, land use decisions, zoning decisions, and so on. But up to now, that kind of planning at the city and county level has been really disconnected from how we plan energy systems, especially the distribution utility. So this idea of a statewide program is the first significant pillar. The second is a foundation basically that requires the electric distribution utilities to become collaborators with local governments on local energy planning. Now, the CPUC is conducting a proceeding on microgrids in pursuit of Senate Bill 1339, from Senator Henry Stern that was passed in 2018. So that CPUC proceeding is taking up a lot of these ideas, and in fact, a track one decision came out on June 17th, which gives specific direction to the investor-owned utilities on a number of things they need to do to start collaborating with local governments and tribal authorities, providing data about their distribution systems, plans for how they're going to upgrade local distribution in areas to deal with greater hardening and resilience, how they operate the system when it's necessary to shut off facilities due to, say, wildfire threats, public safety power shutoffs, conducting workshops at the county level on a semi-annual basis so that they are essentially educating local people on what's going on the distribution system. Because as we develop local energy systems, it's really imperative that the systems not only support big state goals like decarbonization, resilience, and equity, they should also, because they're coming from a local request, they should also, of course, support local priorities and needs. But the third pillar is they should be grid friendly. We should be developing local power systems that don't tax grid operations, don't drive massive infrastructure, but actually can add value to the grid, can actually support grid operations. And that's one reason why collaboration with the distribution utilities is critically important. The third piece I would add that I think needs work, and this is where I think not enough is going on, is when we talk about community microgrids, and now the idea of a community microgrid is you've got a number of loads, consumers, as well as resources over one or maybe multiple utility distribution circuits, and you want that whole thing to operate as a small subsystem and be able to island from the grid. There is no regulatory framework that exists yet in California to do community microgrids. There have been some pilots. There's a lot of work and interest in these, but it will be addressed to some extent in Track 2 of the CPUC's microgrid proceeding, but it's not really a whole system look. And for me, as I think about this, I've been involved with Pacific Northwest National Lab for the last 6 years looking at grid architecture. Grid architecture asks the critical question, who's responsible for what in the power system? And we've inherited a grid architecture from the 20th century, which is totally top-down. Big central power stations, large transmission, power only flows one way, from the bulk power system out to consumers at the other end. And for the most part, consumers are passive. They're just consuming energy. They're not active participants. And we haven't really asked the question in a formal, structured way, what's the role of the distribution utility when we move into a very high distributed resource concentration in the future, which is where we want to go with community energy systems? If we don't ask that question, then we're essentially saying, well, the existing architecture is going to stay with us by default, but that's really not a good answer. We should be moving the industry from this top-down centralized control to a more layered architecture. A very simple illustration, and then I'll stop talking, is the question that's being asked a lot is, does the grid operator, an ISO or an RTO, regional transmission organization, do they need to have visibility and control over hundreds of thousands of distributed resources on their grid? And an awful lot of the technology decisions are going that direction. Essentially, it's taking the centralized control model and building the capability for the grid operator to control everything. An alternative to that, if you look into some of the discipline of grid architecture, is a layered structure whereby the grid operator has visibility and control to the transmission distribution substation, but below that, the distribution utility has now really enhanced its functionality to become a DSO, is the term of art, distribution system operator, and it does a lot of the management and coordination of distributed resource activity. Those two different architectural approaches have very different implications for what kinds of control systems, what kinds of visibility, what kinds of communication and metering and so on. So we should pose the architecture question before we start investing in gazillions of dollars. And this is where I see there's a big gap in policy at both the national level and at most states, is to ask this architectural question. So that's my intro. I look forward to the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lorenzo. Interesting start to the conversation. Larissa, I'm going to unmute your line so you can go ahead and talk.
You want me to go next? Can you hear me?
We'll do Samuel. My bad. Hang on one second here. All right, Samuel, your line's unmuted. Go ahead.
All right, thanks, Sierra.
Samuel Golden Community Choice Partners. I'll build off a little bit conceptually what Lorenzo wrapped up with and then provide a brief update on what's going on the East Coast, which is quite similar. So as Lorenzo was saying, the big picture is that we built a system that doesn't really function well in the current context of what our current challenges and near-term challenges are. And so really this is, you know, we have to reform that. It's the grid architecture that's too centralized, but it's also the governance architecture, like how we make decisions about how the system functions and how reforms function. And it's also the market architecture. So the fundamental drivers that we're trying to get ahead of are rapidly changing technology dynamics, which cause market disruptions and breakdowns, primarily the decentralization of intelligent demand-side resources and distributed energy, electric vehicles, solar, battery storage, so on and so forth. And then the inherent variability of weather-based renewables, wind and solar, and what that does to the markets, and the prices, and the stability of it all. The broader policy challenges are decarbonization and within that, re-architecting of the system, a more holistic way of managing everything, and a more equitable way of managing everything, as we move from a centralized system to a decentralized one. So when you think about it, as Lorenzo was saying, the planning really has to be oriented around the communities. It has to be this bottom-up planning and operational system that we create that unites with our current top-down structure and optimizes it. And it has to be done not just for electricity, but also as we transition off of heating fuels and we retrofit the built environment and we electrify transportation as well. And so all of those systems were built around to serve regional economies. And so that's why this is essentially an exercise, a very massive exercise in institutional capacity building at the local and regional level everywhere around the country. And I gave a webinar on the Municipal Sustainability Forum last year about just how much activity is going on in that sphere at the local and regional level around the country. So in terms of what's going on in the East Coast, I've been helping to architect the new community choice market called Community Power here in New Hampshire, where we've merged kind of a lot of best practices in community choice aggregation with a lot of Lorenzo's thinking on the advanced community energy framework. And broad brushstrokes, what's happening here is that some pretty large structural changes are in the works. So community power programs here are allowed to source power for entire municipalities, but they also have the statutory right to assume control over things like metering and billing and the customer relationship layer. And so they have they could innovate in terms of dynamic rates, consolidated billing. There's no real legal barriers to innovating on the demand side for New Hampshire's new community power market. One of our key goals there is to standardize the entire market for distributed energy across the state. So regardless of which distribution company territory customers are in, we want private sector innovation to be able to come in and at very low cost, operate under a single set of rules and operating assumptions so that they can just focus on helping customers manage their electricity usage costs and carbon content. So in order to do that, we've created a, well, we're in the process of creating a statewide joint action agency to provide shared unified services and a statewide technology platform for all the individual municipal community power programs that launch within the state. We started with a group of about 12 municipalities in December, assessing how best to design the market. And right now, four of them recently took the lead on drafting a joint powers agreement to create this new statewide agency. And we hosted our inaugural summit that drew together 85 officials and staff and energy committee volunteers from 30 municipalities around New Hampshire, which represents about 25% of the default electricity supply in the state. So it's scaling very rapidly, and it seems to have really captured everyone's imagination about just how quickly these sorts of structural changes can play out. Brief update on Connecticut as well, and then I'll turn it over to Larissa. They've just begun an investigation of community power. Their utility regulators have opened a docket to study it, and the first technical workshop is next week. And they're already looking to this new model as a more holistic vision for that state to examine as well.
All right. So, Larissa, let me get you unmuted here. Go ahead.
So you can hear me now?
We're all good, yep.
Okay. And, yeah, I'll build off of what Lorenzo now and Sam have said. I think two things coming, dovetailing off of them, would be, one, a need for addressing the non-utility dimensions, and that can't address the community needs purely through reforming the utility regulatory regime, need to have additional institutional means for addressing directly community and vitally state support. But the other thing, too, to me, this is, as a lawyer, the big elephant in the room, and that's the regulatory reform of utilities. A lot of attention is given to rate design, but even more importantly, a critical need to stamp the revenue model, because without that, you're not going to get the kind of support for change grid architecture. The regulatory incentives that are tied to the revenue model directly affect how you move on grid architecture. So if you don't get the revenue model changed to be aligned with 21st century needs and technology development, there's just going to be that constant tension and lag. And now, in terms of my own updates, a lot has been going on in the D.C. area and Washington metropolitan area, but, as usual, very slowly, always high aspirations. But in, I guess, four main areas here. First, the district council has put out a bill for a distributed energy resource authority and sees the need for addressing these matters on evolving advanced energy communities by looking at the community dimensions and looking outside of the utility regulatory prism. So I'd say first, there is a growing recognition that a non-utility entity of some type is needed with distinctive functions and role and to provide technical assistance guidance, and particularly to oversee master planning that can fuse community development, redevelopment interests with utility also resource planning and development processes, and also to put a focus on the need for new tools and methods that can help support these advanced community endeavors. Second, there's going to be, in the short term, a microgrid proceeding kicking off through the D.C. Public Service Commission. This will build upon the METSIS proceeding, and now it's called PowerPath. And as part of this microgrid proceeding, one of the action items coming out of a METSIS recommendation was to look at institutionalizing a new role for microgrid operators. In the METSIS proceeding, the participants agreed that microgrids really don't fit within the utility definition or definitions of energy service companies, and we need to look at that. And in that, I've been working on developing, institutionalizing a role for microgrid integrated energy service providers for grid-connected communities. Also third, another big area is evolving resilient and sustainable hubs. And here, this is moving very slowly, but along the types of lines that Lorenzo and Sam are talking about. And within this, to try to get, first of all, better alignment between the energy office within the district, it is charged with actually implementing the district's mandates for clean energy, energy efficiency, and to align their clean energy, energy efficiency action plan with steps that the D.C. Public Service Commission needs to take and get good crosswalks, collaboration, coordination, but still dragging, and a big focus in the Public Service Commission domain on how to evolve a grid modernization game plan that can be staged and sequenced to what the Office of Energy is striving to carry out in terms of distributed energy resource development within the district to more cost-effectively achieve the district mandates. So the Public Service Commission's end on this and its modernization efforts are just going to be very critical to really incentivizing appropriate utility investment and the kind of changes in the utility distribution system that could wrap around what the energy office is doing. And this coordination, collaboration is just crucial to cost-effectively achieving those district mandates. If this doesn't occur, there really will be increasingly high costs in terms of electricity bills. In all of this, another area is leveraging federal support. We're talking about state support, but some essential federal support to underpin these kinds of efforts that we're all describing. And right now, the U.S. DOE, Energy Efficiency Renewable Energy, its Building Technologies Office, has kicked off a funding effort. It had a request for information, and now it'll be issuing a request, RFP, to support funding for grid interactive efficient building / connected communities. Using this type of funding can help to build, I think, better partnerships between utilities, local governments, labs, universities, developers, NGOs, etc., to work together in trying to bring about the kind of foundation for interoperability integration needed to get the grid ready, the community ready, so that these efforts between the community and the utility can be better aligned. And in this way, in setting an interoperability integration foundation, try to evolve and take advantage of more accurate price and economic signals to increase the efficiency of energy usage and investment by customers and the community itself. So getting an alignment between the customer community energy decision making and the needs and requirements of the utility system. Also on another plane within the Washington area, we have our Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, and it is trying to get alignment on a regional plane across Maryland, D.C., and Virginia in terms of clean energy and resiliency planning, and to lift and motivate the whole effort to move towards 80% and 100% clean energy. This is really, I think, wrapping around the other efforts I described to try to get better alignment, planning, procurement, and incentive design. But two other areas that are essential to all of this is developing a good data platform, hub, and a lot of the efforts are focused on what's in the utility regulatory domain, but I think the data platform, the resources need to be broader. I think that's really what's been described by Lorenzo and Sam, and beyond just the utility regulatory domain, to cover data platform that could help to service community needs and the overall essential need for general capacity building and technical assistance for local governments, not just individually, but coordinated so they can be empowered and work successfully amongst themselves and getting federal and state support. So those would be my updates.
All right. Thanks so much, Larissa. Bob Perry, you want to add a couple of things? And I have one more person I'd like to call on after you, Bob.
Sure. Yeah, I apologize. I came in a little bit late, and I missed Lorenzo's part, so I'm probably going to repeat a lot of what he says. But, you know, leading into this call, I wrote up a few points, topics that I think really have to be resolved in order for, you know, communities to become, you know, to actually function in the distributed energy society. And the first off is, you know, we have to develop a platform, as was referenced earlier, that engages communities right from the outset. They need to be consulted at the beginning, and they also need to be educated, but they also need to be listened to. I kind of described it as communities are kind of children caught in a bad divorce. You've got different people telling them what they think is best for them, but nobody's really asking them, and nobody's really bringing them into the conversation. So that has to be, you know, a primary goal, which would be achieved by SB 1314 that Lorenzo and the Climate Center have worked to develop. The second thing is we really got to look at, you know, to use a game board analogy, we need to stop just moving pieces around and really look at just redrawing the board, the entire board. There are a lot of things that could be that need to be developed. These procurement, these reactionary procurement procedures like RFPs that just kind of identify a need and then just throw it out there and wait to see what happens comes back. We need to integrate it. We need to make it proactive and part of the planning process within a community. And that would, as Sam had mentioned, would incorporate transportation, EV charging, and take a more holistic approach. There are just a lot of outdated regulations in California. One of them is the Rule 218, the over-the-fence rule. A lot of utilities have that. And while it may have served a purpose back in the day, right now it really only serves as a means of utilities maintaining control. And what we have to do is throw that out, completely throw that out, and look at how can we develop systems that rules and regulations that incentivize maximum development of generation while allowing control over energy by a microgrid or on-site operator. I think a lot of problems is that people are being prematurely restricted in the amount of energy they develop, and they're afraid that if they do develop a lot of energy, the utility will just take control and not allow them to first use that energy for on-site resilience. The second problem is that in order to really develop an equitable distributed system, we have to integrate cost of delivery with the price of energy, which means if you generate energy on site or you get it from an adjacent property, you shouldn't be paying for infrastructure that you're not using. And, you know, energy generated out of state or, you know, in a different part of the state should have to be, the cost of delivering that over transmission infrastructure should be incorporated. And it's only by doing that that you will have a completely level playing field. And that just has to be kind of an overall guiding principle, I think, when you're thinking about, you know, developing equitable energy policy. And finally, we need to really think about, how does this work? How do we build a system where, you know, energy, it serves close, the nearest load first, and then it is equitably, the cost is equitably allocated on that basis. And that's going to require a lot of thought as far as how do we integrate existing distribution systems from the transmission distribution nexus point down to the end user. How do we utilize that system to manage energy effectively and equitably? And these are just kind of broad principles that sometimes I think, you know, kind of get lost in the weeds sometimes. So we need to really keep in mind these overall objectives, and I think that's going to be important going forward, particularly in the phase two component of the SB 1339 proceeding. A lot of that needs to be ironed out. So those are my thoughts.
All right, thanks, Bob. We have a pretty good-sized group today, so I'd like to open it up for questions and conversation among the panelists. Anybody have any thoughts? Dive in.
Well, this is Samuel. It seems like there's a lot of alignment around the need to build new structures and new ways of doing things in a more holistic way that's oriented around community engagement and building capacity at the local level. The question I'd put to everyone is to dig a little deeper on how we're going to do that. And one of the reasons I'm asking this is because I've been trying to merge these advanced community energy frameworks with community choice, because community choice operates in a competitive market context. And so what we see is that when local officials and staff and energy committees get into the business of running a competitive power agency, that provides a very compelling motivation to really pay attention and to deeply understand the business and figure out how to create value and allocate capital efficiently while pursuing policy goals. If that's not there, then what are the impacts from a programmatic perspective? What are the risks that we face as we attempt this large institutional capacity building exercise? And what are the risks for what I just described?
Right. Lorenzo, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lorenzo.
Yeah, fine.
And
Lorenzo,
if anybody wants to speak, do a 4 and a star to unmute your line, because everybody's muted right now. But you can do a number 4 and then press the star button, and you can unmute your line. Go ahead, Lorenzo.
Okay, thanks. Just picking up on, Samuel mentioned the word risk. And I think there's a risk that we need to introduce here for policymakers and regulators at all levels to be thinking about. And to me, that's the risk of what I call unstructured DER adoption. I think, you know, for 100-plus years, if you wanted electricity, you got it from the grid. That was the only place to get it, except for, like, flashlight batteries. But that's just not true anymore. Any customer, any end user, any end use that needs electricity now has a lot of choices. And the grid is only one of those possible choices. They can decide how much of their electricity they want to produce, store, manage their load, all with on-site equipment, and then use the grid as residual supply. Now, who's liable to be the first movers in doing that? The technology keeps getting cheaper. It keeps getting more powerful. So we'll see commercial and industrial customers and more affluent residential customers like gated communities simply making the move, being the first movers, installing on-site equipment, buying less from the grid, and in the extreme, even defecting totally from the grid. I call that unstructured because it's individuals making decisions, whether it's companies, firms, farms, or households. And what I think there's a desperate concern about is that we could have huge stranded assets and a massive equity problem if we don't create a rational regulatory structure to enable DER adoption to reflect what customers and communities want to do, but have them be participants in a network because it's valuable to stay engaged. And it's that structure, to me, that seems like the real leverage here. Let's anticipate that if we don't plan this at a regulatory and policy level, then the unstructured demand is going to really blow us out in the future as customers respond to climate change, to COVID, to the various new threats that are getting worse.
This is Larissa. I got reaction to both. Agree entirely with both San Lorenzo, but again, as a lawyer, what I'm witnessing is this tension with the current legacy utility regulatory regime. Because underlying what both Sam was saying with his emphasis on competitive market context and Lorenzo, you know, unstructured distributed energy resource proliferation, you need a utility regulatory paradigm that has incentives that are aligned with these objectives and can contribute to the advancement of describing. But what we have now in the legal regulatory paradigm, first of all, in terms of the revenue model, places you're talking about the 90%, you know, really more emphasis on capital-intensive infrastructure development, not on rewarding in any way the operational expenditure. There is not, to say the least, the needed equalized treatment between CAPEX and OPEX that could enable the utility distribution company to become an active network manager that can optimize really and use innovative strategies in determining best to really address the CAPEX and the OPEX side of the picture. And much of what we're talking about really taps into the OPEX side of the picture, the energy savings, the efficiencies, the productivity that these resources, microgrids, can bring to the picture within local energy development, yet you have utilities here that remain solidly incentivized to grow, build out the huge capital-intensive infrastructure. And they are sticking with that, and they are trying to entrench their position rather than to bring about this alignment that is needed. And unless you get that, it's going to all be stuck because it's not going to move to enhance the competitive market context, and it's not going to open up the universe to realize the full value of distributed energy resources. So I see that as not just a little cog in the wheel, but a huge one. And as I said, more attention needs to go and pressure put on to change this revenue model. Even revamping the rate design will not be sufficient if that revenue model is not, the barriers are not removed, level playing field, and a new regulatory paradigm developed.
All right, I'd like to open this call to anybody who has not yet had a chance to speak. So So if you would like to say something, go ahead and do a four and then a star.
This is Samuel. I wanted to respond to Larissa really quickly.
Okay. Yeah, then we'll open it up. Go ahead, Samuel, quickly.
Okay. And this is kind of a key point, I feel, because Larissa is absolutely right. The utility business model needs to be reformed. But I think a lot of us jumped the gun in seeking that sort of reform from the current governance architecture of the system. So we expect regulators and legislators and to work out some sort of evolved pathway with utilities, but that has not been working for quite a while. There have been various failed attempts at this stage. And so that's why I think we need to focus on the governance architecture first. We have to change how those sorts of decisions are made. We have to decentralize that in a very real way to communities, and we have to build institutional capacity at that level as quickly as possible so that the investment decisions of the systems and the reforms to the market are being made in a democratic and technically expert way. And so that's why I asked, you know, what is the best way to build out the right sort of local institutional knowledge, and how could that go wrong? So,
all right. I'd like to, Richard Chorsky, are you wanting to contribute to this?
Yeah, hi, thanks. Richard Chorsky here with ZNE Alliance. Lorenzo, just curious about what your vision is for the kinds of municipalities that would have capabilities to do the level of energy planning that you're describing, and how that dovetails with CCA structures. I'm certainly familiar with, a few cities that are typically 100 to 150,000 of population and up, you know, bigger the better, that have energy resilience plans and, you know, maybe a sustainability director or somebody who's thinking about these issues. But my experience is with smaller cities, they just don't have any capacity at all. And then you get, you know, a very partial sort of realization of what might otherwise be a robust community-centric, edge-centric vision for energy. So just curious of your thoughts on how to deal with heterogeneity of municipalities.
Yeah, that's a great question, Richard. I think it goes back to one of the opening comments I made about having a statewide program that provides funding and technical expertise that actually reaches all local governments. They all do some sort of planning, but you're right, many of them are strapped for resources, both the human staff people that are capable and the technical knowledge, as well as the resources, the funding resources to be able to do that. So I think, you know, one step is create a statewide program that's going to create things like templates, a base of technical knowledge, be able to hire expertise to go and work collaboratively with the local governments and provide them funding to be able to do the local planning, along with at least enough utility reform to give them requirements for the distribution utilities to provide their expertise to the local governments to be able to plan. And some of this is contained in the Track 1 decision of the CPUC microgrid proceeding. Then what I would add to that, as Bill Dodd's SB 1314 does, start with simpler things at the local level like resilience projects, a critical facility, fire stations, wastewater and water pumping, community centers that can house a couple of hundred people when they get dislodged from where they live in a neighboring town or in the region, so that the technical capabilities are relatively minimal to create a single facility microgrid, but it gets the community engaged in thinking about, well, what are our high priorities? What are the things that we need to protect first? What are the risks that we're facing? And so start that dialogue. And I think these are steps that already the CPUC is thinking about, already some legislators are thinking about, because resilience has become a hot topic now that we've seen the power shutoffs and the fire threats in California.
All right. Anybody else?
Go ahead. This is Peter.
Let me have Peter Millman talking. I know you've been waiting for a while here. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, this is Peter Millman in Connecticut. I guess that my comment would be that I think the simplification of the discussion, the vision of community power, community choice aggregation, is a key part of this. In other words, all of this involves building community involvement, community understanding, and yet the discussion involves so much stuff that ordinary people are not familiar with, about the structure of the grid, the regulatory structure within any given state. I've been talking about community choice in Connecticut for almost 2 years, and it's been stunning to me how few people understand it. And I don't say that as an expert. I'm somebody who went through the evolution of community choice from Massachusetts in 1997 to what Samuel is doing in New Hampshire in 2019, 2020. I've gone through that evolution of understanding in about 2 years, and it's been tough. I'm sure that all of you spend time popularizing, simplifying, explaining to your messages to people who would be energy advocates at the community level or at the state level. But of course, you also have to talk to state regulators and power companies and et cetera. And I think that that's what missing, that that's a big part of what's missing here. And I would just encourage that some part of the work of this be simplification. We sort of need a Carl Sagan of community choice and community power.
All right. I'd like to have people who are not muted right now mute their phones, please. There's a couple of you. And Benny Hayden, you had something you wanted to contribute to the conversation, and then we'll go ahead and I can see a couple other people want to talk. So, Benny, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Sierra. Hi, this is Benny Hayden. I'm based in Atlanta. And I've, you know, just listening to some of the comments today, I do think there's a window of opportunity presented by COVID, and in the sense of, you know, even with respect to utilities, you know, it'll be interesting to see how, you know, the fact that their income streams have been affected by this downturn in the economy. So they may be more receptive going forward to listening to new ideas as how they can partner to address issues in the community. You know, one of the things that COVID has exposed is, of course, the, you know, vulnerabilities of, you know, low-income communities as it relates to, you know, the disease itself. And I think, you know, someone mentioned about simplification, and I think if you think about, you know, say, developing projects that segment low-income communities, and one good example of that is, say, seniors. Seniors are, even before COVID, they were very vulnerable to, say, power outages, particularly seniors who rely on, say, home healthcare equipment, you know, that's powered by electricity. And I think by approaching, you know, say, seniors, and then also, you know, how you can involve economic development, which is always a key, you know, issue when you talk about, you know, low-income communities. So I think, you know, by identifying benefits in these areas, you are able to, say, create awareness in the community that in some cases may put the utility, you know, even maybe on the defensive. And so I think you kind of, you know, maybe want to think about perhaps, you know, just kind of like chipping away at it in terms of, you know, how utilities are perceived in the community. And but that would just be my kind of two cents on it. And I think, though, know, there is a window, you know, to look at it in terms of how we can integrate, you know, some of these issues with, you know, low-income communities, and, you know, how we can use these projects to address that.
Okay, so I muted everybody because we were hearing quite a bit of background noise. So if you'd like to speak to a 4-star, and I can tell that you're ready to speak.
Yeah, this is
Baird. Baird, go ahead. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Baird. Baird Brown, go ahead. You have to unmute your phone, too.
Yeah, my own phone was muted, sorry.
You're good.
Thanks, Sierra. This has been a great discussion. I really enjoyed it. I'm going to try and follow up with a couple of people. I would sort of just add in a couple of thoughts that may be helpful. There are disconnects, as I forget which speaker mentioned, in the planning process, but there are actually resources for planning that haven't usually gotten to the energy sector, and that includes both the emergency planning whole apparatus, which every state has to have an emergency planning office and does, and they have various powers and functions. And then there are the funded, the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission, where I am, you know, started out for transportation planning, and, you know, I think that's where most of their funding comes from, but they just held a microgrid webinar for municipal officials. So there are pockets of existing planning with existing fingers into lots of communities that are, you know, worth coordinating and bringing into the conversation, and are already in effect both building and providing capacity that shouldn't be overlooked.
All right. I'd like to interject one thing here. We've talked a lot about the vision, a lot of things that need to be done. I'd like people to be thinking about the process. What are the steps we need to take one at a time from the beginning to achieve some of these goals? And if you want to email me with that, with a short paragraph or two, I know it's a longer topic than that, but just some ideas. We'll have some conversations around that, and those will turn into webinars, because this is something I've been thinking about for quite a while, is to put on webinars with a process so people can see what they need to do to make these things happen. So anyhow, go ahead. Anybody else? I think, Bob, here, you wanted to talk. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just a couple of points as to the question about, you know, what do the smaller communities do. I think this is an area where community choice aggregators or organizations, regional organizations, can really play a key role. They can develop programs that help the types of communities within their service territory. And I think they can also help to a great degree to help aggregate. I think in order for distributed energy to really advance, there's going to need to be a lot of aggregation to bring economies to scale and to bring prices down. As Lorenzo alluded to, if people are just reacting ad hoc, site owners by themselves, they're paying a much higher price than maybe they would otherwise have to if they were part of a program that was part of an overall aggregated procurement. They could get much better prices. With respect to Peter's observation regarding the need to engage community, I think schools are the ultimate lens to educate the community, and should be. I mean, they're objectively critical facilities from a strictly energy standpoint, but they also the ability to develop, once you have microgrids at school, to develop curricula, teach the kids can teach the parents, they can have events at the school to educate the public. I think schools would be serve a real critical function in that area. And those are my two comments.
All right. Anybody else here? You want to talk to a 4-star and unmute your phone?
Lorenzo? This is Larissa. Can I say something?
No. Sure, Larissa. Go ahead.
One quick thing on the process. I think running across what everybody is saying, we need mechanisms to bring down the silos. Whether within local governments, they're siloed as to how they administer their planning as to different, you know, end-use sectoral areas. We need to bring down the silos in terms of coordinating, harmonizing better what the utility does with the community in terms of local energy development, distributed energy resource, value creation. And I think we really have to focus on these mechanisms. And I'll go back to something because I was involved with this way, way back in California, but I think Lorenzo mentioned the Strategic Growth Council in California. And if it still has the same mission as when I saw way back it was authorized, that is an entity that is charged with trying to bring down these silos and provide that leadership from the top to cross-cut, like, the different divisions at the state level, and then bring, you know, break down the silos also in terms of the local government planning and the silos between the local government and the utility. So I think addressing and those kind of mechanisms that could break up these silos so that we can better tap into existing resources and match them with new technological capabilities is essential.
All right. One thing here before we go, we only have a couple more minutes. Tomorrow we have another call on July 8th, and it's the challenges of integrating and managing renewable energy within a muni. And Richard Chase from Chase Systems, Dick White from Colorado, and Jerry Braun, Integrated Resources Network, will be on the panel. And anybody else that has any experience in this area, please feel free to join so we can have that discussion. I think munis are very important and apparently not really easy to approach. So anybody else here on this topic? Oh, by the way, it's at a strange time. It's going to be at 3:30 Eastern time tomorrow, so a little different than normal. Anybody else here? About 1 minute left. Okay. All right.
Hi,
well, good
Sarah.
Discussion. Go ahead. Uh-huh. Who's this?
Yeah. Oh, this is Samuel. And
Samuel,
I just wanted to
sure.
respond to Peter, who was emphasizing that we all need to get, you know, do a better job at communicating these concepts in a more generic and relatable fashion. And I couldn't agree more. Lorenzo wrote a brilliant article a few years ago that influenced a lot of us called The Future of Tomorrow's, or Lorenzo, what was it called? Like The Future of Tomorrow's Electricity Energy World, comma, Today. And it was kind of written from the perspective of looking back, you know, 20, 50 years about what our assumptions were now and about how we evolved over time. And it really helped me to kind of think through a lot of these concepts that would otherwise be pretty hard to grapple with, so I'd recommend that. I also have a webinar coming up on July 14th for how to think through community choice market design on the Municipal Sustainability Forum, and I'm going to try my hardest to do what you're asking there.
Actually, the webinar is on the 15th, not the 14th, I'm pretty sure.
Oh. Thanks. Sorry.
Yeah. I'll tell you, if anybody shows up, it's going to be a miracle because we changed the date twice. Yeah. No, we're in pretty good shape. So, okay. Anybody else here? All right. Well, we're going to obviously have more discussions on this again. It was a really large group today. And thanks, everybody, for coming. Panelists, thanks so much. It was an excellent conversation. And hope to hear from you again, and please send me some information about what you think we should be talking about as far as the process is concerned. I've got some of my own ideas, but I'd like to hear from you for sure. So we'll hope to see you tomorrow, and thanks again.
Thank you.